This is Don Stevens on the Côte d'Azur, February the 20th, 1983, and registering a tape for David Fenster in connection with the detailed book that he is putting together on Baba's life. The first bit of history that I will try to record relates back to the visit that Francis Brabazon and I paid to India at Baba's invitation to attend the four language groups. That has, of course, been very thoroughly and amply written up, as it was the base for all of the material for the first part of the book Listen Humanity. However, there are perhaps just a few minor surrounding details that could possibly be of interest in some way, because so many things that occur even not in Baba's presence on such a memorable occasion obviously have his stamp and guidance and authority behind them. I remember that during the course of this visit, Baba sent me with Francis Brabazon and Adi Jr. to see the Ellora Caves. Of course, it's rather unusual for Baba to send one of his devotees on a sightseeing expedition, but oddly enough, during his lifetime, he sent me on two separate occasions to the Ellora Caves for his own purposes. He never elaborated. The only point that came out eventually was that Baba himself had spent quite some time alone or on occasion with Erish in the great main temple hall of Kailash Temple, which is the most imposing of the Ellora Caves. Perhaps Baba's wish for me to go there had something to do with his own past work in Kailash Temple. At any rate, on this particular occasion, as we were driving over to see the Ellora Caves and to stay at the government guest house, I believe it was originally owned by the Nizam of Hyderabad. En route, we stopped at a little Indian village. Francis and Adi Jr. jumped out to have a cup of tea. They asked if I would like to come in and have something, or perhaps an orange squash. But on this first occasion to India, and I must admit on other occasions too, my stomach was so queasy that even the thought of a cup of tea was just too much. I couldn't face it. So I said, no, I'm a bit tired and stomach a bit upset, so you go ahead and I'll just sit here and rest. The driver of the car remained in the front seat. I think it was Nariman's car and driver that Baba had used on this occasion for our trip. The driver sat in the front seat and I suppose to ward off anybody who might try to disturb me or beg. But eventually, as I leaned with my eyes closed against the back corner of the car inside, I had the sense that there was someone quite near me, and I opened my eyes, stared out of the roll-down window, and there was a very tall, thin, gaunt old man, absolutely hung with rags. His clothes were so tattered they looked as if they could fall off in just a little breath of the wind. He had on a typical turban, somewhat better than the rest of his clothing. Very thin face, bit of a gray beard, and he was simply looking quietly at me. He seemed to be chewing on something. He said nothing. He didn't put out his hand for alms. This surprised me. And I wondered, well, what's going to go on? Eventually, he reached his right hand down somewhere in the inside of all of these tatters that passed for clothing, and eventually drew out three beautiful, beautiful oranges. Absolutely impeccable. The driver understood a little English, and so I said to him, "No, no, no, tell the man that I don't want to buy anything." And the driver talked just a moment with the old man, and the old man shook his head and replied rather quickly, and the driver said, "Oh, but Sahib, he doesn't want to sell you the oranges, he wants to make a gift of them." I must admit, this being my first experience in India, I thought it was one of those rather curious come-ons, a means of actually getting you to take something and pushing you, in turn, to give something back. So, I felt that in a strange country and in the face of customs unknown to me, that I must do something or another. So I reached my hand out, took the three oranges from the gentleman, nodded my head, smiled, and then felt in my pocket and found I had some rupees. So I said to the driver, "Now, please tell the old man that he has been so kind. Now, I would like to give him a gift in return." I had decided inside of myself that I might as well make the best of the situation, even though I didn't want the oranges. So, again, the driver spoke for just a few moments quickly with the old man. The old man shook his hand and waved his right hand in negation, and the driver explained to me, "No, you misunderstand, Sahib. The old gentleman saw you sitting here. He came up to see who you were. He likes you. He feels you are a good man, and he would like to present this gift to you, but you must not give him anything in return. It would spoil the entire spirit of how he feels." So, I must say I was absolutely cut to the core, touched very, very deeply. And also, I must say, quite frankly, ashamed of my suspicions. This seemed absolutely, on my first visit to India, to set the tenor. It became the stamp in my mind of a type of deep warmth and generosity, spontaneous, which does not depend upon any sense of return, reward, reciprocity. So then on we went, of course, and had a magnificent stay at the guest house and saw the Ellora Caves, which were simply something out of this world. I'd never seen their equivalent in art. As I say, the language group meetings themselves have been carefully written up as part one of Listen Humanity. I'm not sure whether in the end of the description I described the occasion when Baba was calling me up to the end room in Upper Maribod Hall, the building built on top of the old water storage tank. Francis Brabazon and I used one of the two rooms, and every once in a while during the language meetings, Baba would pop in and out of the other room. Just what he might have been doing, I would have no idea. But on the last day before I was to continue my journey, as set out by Baba, through northern India and then back home, Baba called me into the far room, and he was sitting there. I believe Arish was standing at his side to translate his gestures, one or two of the other mandali. And Bob asked, of course, how I'd enjoyed the meetings. The whole stay, of course, was something so incredible, so beautiful, and so very, very deeply moving that I had great difficulty in expressing any sort of sentiment. This was always typical of me, and I think typical of many people in Baba's presence. One found oneself tongue-tied, and all one could do was to feel utter frustration in not being able to carry on one's own side of conversation with Baba, and also a deep, overwhelming sense of warmth, which in any case could not have been put into words, even if one had been in better form. I noticed that Baba had a small chair placed beside his chair, and on that were various papers, a small stack of them. Of course, Baba had so many things going on all the time that I just noted the little stack of papers in passing without any idea that they would figure in the conversation between us. But eventually, as Baba drew to a close his and my reactions to the language group meetings, then he beckoned for the papers, and Arish, I believe, handed it to him. Baba put them on his knee, riffled through them, and then gestured, and Arish said, Baba has here a collection of various things that he has given out at various public gatherings, some of them about the length of a normal discourse, some of them just one or two or three paragraphs, some of them just a sentence or two. But all of these have been carefully collected by his secretaries, and they have never been published before. Baba wants to know if you would like to take this collection, edit it as you have done on God Speaks, work it up, handle it in any fashion that you feel fit, and perhaps make it into a small book which you can put out after God Speaks appears. Of course, I immediately said, yes, I would like to do this, be very, very happy, and of course, again, deeply touched that Baba would show this confidence, this grace. Then Baba went on, and he seemed to have another idea. He was saying, in fact, you might possibly want to combine it in some fashion, and Baba would leave that entirely in your hands, combine it in some fashion with a description of what you've experienced at your meeting, in your attendance of the language groups. I immediately started nodding my head, and Baba continued, if this appeals to you, Don, then Baba will make available to you the secretary's transcripts of what Baba has said at the meetings, and you can weave your own description of the events around the secretary's reports. I said I thought this was an absolutely wonderful idea, and as a consequence, would be very happy to take back the papers, make one section from that, and probably quite a separate section giving the story and the accounting of what went on at the first language group. When this was all agreed to, Baba said, well, then for liaison on the project, because you will need to consult someone here for any help and for papers that you need, so Baba will have Ramju Abdullah and Baal Naptu work with you. And as you finish material or anything that you're in doubt about, you can correspond with them. So that was how the material was handed over for Listen Humanity. I then went on up. Baba had planned out rather carefully the remainder of my stay in India as I was to go back to the United States. Of course, seeing the Taj Mahal at Agra was one thing. I believe we discussed whether or not it would be full moon, and no, it wasn't full moon. And so, well, then there was no need to get up in the middle of the night and go see the Taj again. But Baba had planned that, and then on to New Delhi, where I was to be met by one of his close lovers there, Vasudev Kane. Kane at that time was the private secretary to the president of India, lived on the president's estate, the government president's estate in New Delhi. He was to show me the Qutub Minar, a very ancient tower just on the edge of Delhi, and take me around to see various things that Baba had requested that I see in New Delhi. Why Baba completely disobeyed his own general rule to come directly to India to see Baba and go directly back without sightseeing or visiting of saints or shrines, I do not know. Absolutely no idea. I guess it had something or another to do with my own particular peculiarities. There was another occasion when Baba planned an even more elaborate trip, but I'll go into that when we get historically to the right point. There were several other trips to India. I unfortunately did not keep notes. I must admit that to start, it was only with great reluctance that I took motion pictures of Baba, because one of my friends on this first trip threatened to cut off our friendship for life if I didn't take his motion picture camera and make every effort to catch Baba. That was in a period when it was rare to see Baba. He was going increasingly into long seclusions. And so for the West, for anyone to have the chance to be around Baba and to take photos and to bring them back, of course, was too great an opportunity to be missed. But for better or for worse, I did not take notes. I let the motion picture camera on that first occasion be the additional note-keeping, aside from what I immediately tried to write down from my recollections to form my narrative part around the language group in 1955. On those other trips, there were various little incidents that happened. For instance, I remember on one occasion, Baba, who was always so kind and thoughtful, thought that I might be getting a little bored, so he arranged for Dr. Duncan to take me in tow one afternoon. So off I went with Duncan and the driver in the car, and Duncan thought that I might be interested in seeing a herd of monkeys. Actually, all I'd ever seen for a monkey before that time was in a zoo. And the thought of seeing them in their native habitat, a bunch of them maybe swinging through trees, I'd always been fascinated by the Tarzan stories as a boy. At any rate, it attracted me, and I responded with enthusiasm. So off we went to somewhere or another where there was a canyon and trees and a bit of rainforest. And Duncan said, now, ordinarily, the monkeys are quite close at hand here. But they weren't, and so Duncan had the driver go a little bit further in the road until it virtually petered out. Still no monkeys. And Duncan said, well, they must be a bit deeper in the canyon, and let's, if you don't mind, let's go a little bit on foot. Well, as we started going on foot, and it was apparent that we would have to go still deeper into this virtually trailless, thicketed canyon, Duncan suddenly remembered and said, Don, incidentally, every once in a while in this area, in this type of rainforest, you'll find a type of a creeper which sticks to your clothing. And I must warn you, be terribly careful about that. Call to me if one of them gets entangled in your clothes. Don't risk taking it off because they have rather poisonous spines on them. Not mortally poisonous, but you'll come out with a very heavy rash if you touch them. Well, with this rejoinder, Duncan went off, and of course, Duncan being a much better mountain climber and explorer than Stevens ever was, he soon lost me. He was bent on finding the monkeys, and eventually I thought, well, I'm getting lost too. I think I'd better climb back up the hillside as long as I know roughly the direction of the car so I don't get lost and everybody have a heck of a time trying to find me. So I started on my own climbing back up, and perhaps had gone 5 or 10 minutes when all of a sudden I found I couldn't move. So I looked down to see what was holding me, and I saw that wrapped around one arm and over the back of my loosely held sweater and down over one trouser's leg was a long green vine of some sort, which, lo and behold, had stuck very tightly to me. Well, I tried to move forwards and backwards and to unwind it without using my hands, because immediately it occurred to me that this was the poisonous vine that Duncan had warned me about. But no matter how I tried, all I did was to get myself more enmeshed in the vine. And finally, I decided the only way I was going to get out of there was try as gingerly as I could to take the end of it, which I could see, and start lifting it, and then holding the end as gingerly but as firmly as I could, unwind myself little bit by little bit from the vine. I did exactly that, and I thought it had been quite a successful operation. I didn't touch the vine except with the very ends of my thumb and first finger. And finally got myself loose, came back up to the car. Eventually Duncan came back and said, "Oh, I'm sorry that I lost you, Don. I never did find the monkeys. Did you see them?" And I said, "No, I didn't." I didn't mention the poisonous vine because, quite frankly, it had left my mind. I felt I'd been so careful about it that there is no need even to refer further to the matter. So back we went, and Baba immediately wanted to know if we'd found the monkeys. No, and so on. Well, the next morning when I woke up, I was staying that time in the Blue Bus. I noticed that I had a little rash on my right hand. I thought, oh, that is a more powerful vine than I would have thought. But at any rate, I thought nothing of it. And shortly after I'd had breakfast and gone to the loo, it was time for Baba to come to Mondley Hall. And as usual, he immediately had things in his mind that he wanted to talk about. I forgot completely about my hand. But all of a sudden, I saw Baba stop gesturing, and he was looking at me. And as he looked at me, I noticed that unconsciously I was scratching my right hand with my left hand. And Baba, you know, always was so meticulously careful about, especially the Westerner's health and whether anything might go wrong. He looked upon us as a bunch of hothouse flowers, at least those of us who were new to India. And always asked meticulously about everything to do with our health first thing in the morning when we would see him. So he said, "Don, what's that?" And I said, "Oh, I don't know, Baba, just a little bit of a rash." Of course, it's at the times like that that you suddenly have borne back upon you the fact that Baba is God and that all knowledge is one of the attributes of God. He knew. And yet, just from force of habit, of course, even with God, you try to cover up. So I tried to evade the issue, and then I began to think, my golly, if Baba digs into this, I'm going to get poor Duncan in Dutch. Well, Baba just wouldn't have an evasive answer from me. With very deft manners of prying, he soon had at least the story out of me that I'd touched one of these poisonous vines. So he reared back in his chair in horror and threw up his hands and gestured, "But where was Duncan? Why didn't Duncan save you from that?" Well, you know, again, I tried to be evasive, but first thing you know, the part of the story came out that Duncan and I had been afoot in the canyon looking further, and we'd been separated. Well, that horrified Bobby even further, that Duncan hadn't stuck to me like a leech. This poor little old hothouse flower, Stevens, left on his own in a horrible, dangerous canyon, you know. So immediately, Baba gestures, "Go fetch Duncan." I just felt sick at heart. So Just a few minutes later, Baba was quiet, I was quiet. Nobody said anything until Baba came on the run. And Baba immediately, furiously started asking Duncan all of the details. And Duncan, of course, just fessed up, as we say. He told exactly what had gone on, but I interrupted and said, Baba, I'm sorry, I didn't tell Duncan anything about it because I thought I'd handle the vine so carefully. Well, Baba was annoyed, and that, of course, was a perfect occasion for dressing down Duncan. You know, Baba was a tremendous disciplinarian. If one wavered one hair's breadth from what was agreed to or instructed, there was all hell to pay. So Duncan, of course, had been through this many times, but it was the first time that I'd ever seen Baba really take someone to task. And I wanted to crawl right underneath my cushion and disappear. But I loved Duncan very much, and I hated to see him being raked over the coals because, really, of my own carelessness. At any rate, there was nothing to do, and all I could do was just sit and feel a bit sick at heart. Finally, Bob had had enough of that and dismissed Duncan and went back to whatever subject he'd been handling, and eventually I went back to the blue bus, and it was time for lunch and so on. In the afternoon, as Baba almost always did, he came again. And on this occasion, all of a sudden he broke in, broke his conversation, his gestures, and looked at me, and I realized that I was again scratching away. And at this point, it wasn't just my hand, but there were red splotches up my arm. And Baba said to Erish, Erish, don't you have some sort of a powder that's good for this type of a rash? Erish disappears and comes back with some sort of a tin. I start sprinkling it gingerly on myself, and Erish gets impatient, takes it away from me, and gives great dollop sprinkles of it all over and pats it down until I start to look on that side like a pancake artist. So finally, Baba seemed satisfied with it all, and it did seem to allay the itching a bit. Erish cautioned me that when I went to bed that night that I should put it not just on the affected parts, but all over the arm and probably on the other one. When I woke up the next morning, apparently the powder hadn't prevented much spreading because it was all over my right arm, starting on my left arm, and even was down on one leg in some patches. Well, I had visions of a real mess, not just Baba's annoyance, but a real mess health-wise. So I went into Mondalee Hall, tried consciously to remind myself not to scratch, but first thing you know, I was scratching. Baba said, Don, come here. He looked at me and looked at all of these splotches and insisted on seeing my leg and where all it had spread. And then he motioned me to go back and said, Erish, your powder doesn't seem to be doing very much good for Don. Baba tried to carry on the subject. I must admit that I was half preoccupied by concentrating on which part of me was itching most and scratching it and trying to listen to Baba. And finally, Baba looked as if he was going to be impatient, and then he didn't, and he reached over. It was rather warm, getting on towards midday, reached over to the little table at the side, and there was, as always, a lovely, white, fresh linen handkerchief. He reached over, unfolded it, mopped his brow, looked at me, beckoned to me. I didn't know what he was going to do, and so I came up close to him, and he took the handkerchief, put it in my hands, and I realized that for the first time I was to get one of these treasured handkerchiefs on which Baba had wiped his brow. Always before, whenever I had been present when somebody got one of Baba's handkerchiefs, first of all, it wasn't Don, and if I remember it, it had always been one of the charming ladies somewhere or another around Baba. So this was my first experience to get one of Baba's handkerchiefs, and I was touched and deeply, deeply affected. So I put it between my hands, thanked Baba for it, and backed away, sat down. Well, Baba went on with whatever important thing it was that he wanted to be sure that I understood. And finally, it was the end of the session, and Baba motioned us all to leave. As I left, all of a sudden I became aware of the fact that I hadn't been scratching lately. And that amazed me a little bit. But you didn't have to have been around Baba very much to have learned the lesson that the unexpected could and almost always did happen around Baba. So I thought, well, somewhere or another, Baba got annoyed with Stevens' preoccupation with his itching and has brought it under control. At any rate, I was very happy that I wasn't in such misery, but I still had great big red splotches over about, well, close to a half of my body by that time. But nevertheless, when I went to bed, I was reasonably comfortable. When I woke up the next morning, the puffiness had left almost everywhere. My legs were almost back to normal with very little splotches of red on them. My left arm rapidly going down, only parts of my right arm were still a little bit alarming looking. By late in the day, it had disappeared. As a matter of fact, Baba didn't even bother to ask any more about it. He obviously knew the whole story, what was necessary in order to get me back concentrating on what he wanted done and not be annoyed and distracted by such a point as that. I did a good deal of reflection on that and a few other incidents because, as everyone knows, Baba says that he does not work miracles. My own feeling is that we managed to concentrate so much on the miracles that Christ used to shake people, to wake them up, to get them to start reflecting and to listen to what he was saying. And we have concentrated so much on the miraculous and so much less, unfortunately, on the actual words and the concepts that he was trying to drill into us, that I suspect in this avataric incarnation, Baba was trying to avoid that sort of a sidetracking. Nevertheless, there is no question in my mind that when there was something which was just dead necessary to get done in order to get the avataric will on the rails in a situation, Baba would use his powers very quietly and with that very little fanfare or recognition of it. I think it certainly is the responsibility of those who feel deeply drawn to Baba, who love Baba, to follow his will, his direction in this, and to concentrate as little as possible on the unusual course of events. Sometimes they're fun stories, of course, but nevertheless, I think it's our responsibility to try to avoid blowing these things up and instead to concentrate on Baba, his love, and his precepts that he passes on to us. There were a number of other little incidents. I can't relate any of them to a specific dateline, but they are incidents typical of Baba that come to my mind from time to time. I remember on one occasion during those years when I was traveling a great deal all over Europe and the Far East on petroleum business and would periodically have the grace to be able to stop to visit Baba, just sometimes for 1, 2, 3 days en route. On one of those occasions, I had been negotiating in Tokyo. A weekend was coming up. I had nothing special to do. I found that by leaving the negotiations a bit early on Friday, I could catch a late plane, which would actually get me into Bombay on Saturday. If Baba would let me, I'd be able to spend Saturday at Ahmednagar, at Marizad, and go rapidly back to Bombay, catch a plane early Sunday, and get back in position for negotiations on Monday. I think it was a cable that I sent to Bob outlining this possibility, and at once it was accepted. When I got to Bombay, having slept pretty well on the plane, I took a taxi direct to Ahmednagar. The taxi drove me to where Baba was. I can't remember at that moment whether he was at Marizad or for the day at Maribad. But in any case, he was expecting me. There were some visitors there. Baba was telling them stories and asking them things about family and lives and so on. As I came in, a bit breathlessly, Baba broke off and explained who I was and the fact that I had taken a taxi all the way up from Bombay just to be with him for a few hours, would take it back that evening. Baba was not averse to mentioning money and such things. He wanted to know how many rupees it was going to cost me. I think it was all in all somewhere around $100, $200 that the round trip cost, a fair sum of money. Everybody looked a bit impressed, and so then Baba looked very debonair and said, well, if I asked Don to, he would go jump off a cliff, wouldn't you, Don? Well, when Baba asks you something like that direct, you don't take it as a rhetorical question. There is too much possibility, even probability, that he is building up to something which is going to be rather tough. So I must admit that I reflected for a few seconds before I replied, just wondering what under the sun I was going to get myself in for this occasion. And then I thought, good heavens, I can't do any quibbling in front of Baba's guests. So I promptly said, yes, I would, Baba, and just trusted that if something of that sort became necessary, Baba would give me the courage to do it. I think one of the early stories also that touched me very deeply was in this latter part of the 1950s. It was shortly after Baba had given me the job of working out the papers which became Listen Humanity, and after it had gone to press, I was rather lazy for some period of time. It had been, what, 3 very, very intensive years working originally on the editing of God Speaks, and then the much more lengthy process of its being put to press, proofread, and so on, publicity. And then again, the sheer work of Listen Humanity took a lot of time and energy, well over a year. And again, all of the business of proofreading, going to press, and so on. So when that was done, well, I say I think it was about 3 years that all of that took. When all of that was done, then I just sort of relaxed and sort of wiped my brow and said, phew, and enjoyed life. On one of the occasions when I had a chance to stop by to see Baba, perhaps a year after all of that had happened, one of the first things Baba said after I had embraced him, he had embraced me in Mandalay Hall, was just the blunt question, Don, what are you doing with Baba's words these days? Well, I knew exactly what he was driving at. In fact, my conscience several times had tossed up the fact to me that I really was goofing off, that I was taking life much too easy, and that it was about time that I got back and did some sort of creative work in relation to Baba. Nevertheless, just thinking that I'd be a little cute and maybe dodge the issue, I replied to Baba, Baba, I actually haven't been doing anything with your words. I've just been basking in your love. Well, Baba looked pleased, smiled, and raised his right hand in the little circle gesture of perfection, changed the subject, went on. But after about perhaps half an hour, all of a sudden he looked very directly at me and very concentratedly and again gestured, but seriously, Don, what are you doing with Baba's words? Well, at that point, I knew that it wasn't going to do any good to try to be cute and evasive. So I faced up to it with a blunt reply and said, "Baba, really, I've done nothing, and I do feel ashamed of myself. I've had a feeling that I should get back and start reading your words and studying them again, now that all of the writing, the editing is done." And Baba said, "Do that." Changed subject, left it. Well, it was very shortly after that, by one of those beautiful Baba bits of grace, that I was able to see Baba again. The first thing that he asked me as he sat down was, "Well, Don, now what have you done with Baba's words?" And quite frankly, I had totally forgotten the episode. I was, first of all, mortified, because usually my memory doesn't play a trick on me like that. But secondly, I knew, have always known, that one absolutely must follow through, fulfill whatever one says one is going to do for Baba. Or if Baba assigns something, do it. Get it done promptly. It's top priority. So for these reasons, I felt absolutely sick inside of myself. I just couldn't imagine how I could have been so negligent. So I said, "Baba, I'm ashamed. Life has been so busy that it just did completely skip my mind. But I promise you, I won't come back again without having done some good homework." Baba smiled and again immediately changed the subject, and soon the trip was over. When I went back to, I think I was in California at that point, Perth Amboy, New Jersey, hopping back and forth across the Atlantic and handling our company's crude oil business in Western Europe, when I got back, I dug out the Deshmukh 5-volume edition of the Discourses, which I hadn't read at that point for perhaps 7-8 years. Originally, I thought they were good, parts interesting, but they didn't strike me as spectacular, and I'd often thought that I ought to go back and reread them. So I did start them, and immediately was struck by the tremendous meaning, the pungency of virtually every sentence. And I wondered how under the sun I could have read them before and have failed to be excited by all of the magnificent things that they contain. Shortly again, I was back in India and so impressed by what I'd been reading in the Discourses that I brought up the subject with Baba and said, "Baba, I have fulfilled my promise." I went back and have been rereading the Discourses, and I think they're absolutely terrific, Baba. In fact, I have a feeling that these will probably be the basic book given out by you for the young people who are starting to knock on the doors of the Sufis and various Baba groups around the world. That was just beginning to be the start of the dropout period, the hippie period, the love period, the flower children, all of the experimentation, the searching that was to go on, especially in the 60s. And some of those people had started to turn up, and I just felt that the Discourses would be the thing to refer them to get their noses to the grindstone. But I had noticed that the styling of the 5-volume edition of the Discourses was more Indian English than it was English or American English. Very often inverted sentence structures, which is a bit awkward, and one would unconsciously spend a bit of time unscrambling and reinverting just to be sure what the sense was. Rarely, but once in a while, a word actually misused or a slight mistake in grammar. So I said, "But Baba, there is one thing. There is enough time that one has to spend reflecting on some of the slightly odd usage of English in them, that I think they should be re-edited into completely fluid and flowing Western style." And then I hadn't thought of it at all, but the idea suddenly struck me, and I said, "Baba, would you entrust that editing job to me. Baba immediately waggled his head and said yes, and said, go talk to Adi Sr. about it, because he handles those things for Baba, so you should know about it. But I'm certain that he will say yes also. So I did talk to Adi, and that was the way the project began. For